We're at an all-time high. We have to get that Bond song out there, probably, and because we're pouring money in the system and everybody loves it, and then we're bitching at the head of the Treasury. He's stupid. Okay, do we have Mr. Liu?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I'm good. We're recovering out here from a monster hailstorm that mercifully missed my house, but put so much hail on the streets of Aurora, which is about, I don't know, 2 miles maybe east of us.
I've been there.
So much hail on the streets of Aurora that cars were stuck in it, and they had to activate snowplows to come out and clear the streets.
Could you just wait a little bit? Was it 80 degrees?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't melting. That was the problem. It wasn't melting fast enough. It was up over the hubcaps.
Really?
The hail was so heavy. It was up over the hubcaps of cars that were driving in the area, and then a bunch of them got, like, I mean, they had video of about 4 or 5 cars stuck, but I think it was a fairly narrow swath of incredibly dense hail. But to have a foot and a half of hail on the ground in, you know, what, 5 minutes?
I thought a couple inches last year in Audrey's porch was a lot. A couple of feet's got to be a lot more.
Yeah, we get these every now and then, and I remember driving up to the mountains, going through a little town called Woodland Park, and we came in on the backside of a storm that had just hit the place, and there was there were drifts, you know, 2 feet high of hailstones.
Wow.
In parking lots and off to the side of the road, and that's pretty much what happened last night.
Why do you walk on it? It's like walking on marbles.
Oh, well, you don't want to be out in something like that. I mean, it tears leaves off trees, breaks branches, breaks car windshields, and if you're out there, you're getting a bruising because you're going to get pelted. So, yeah, it was a mess. So anyway, we're recovering from that now. I think most of it's probably melted off.
Were the hailstones big enough to dent the cars?
Golf ball sized.
So was that a yes?
Oh yeah.
So yeah, everybody's getting hail damage on their cars.
I'm sure that's probable. I think they were recording 80 mile an hour wind gusts. So if you get, even if it's just not just falling from the sky, but it's being blown by, you know, gusting winds up to 80 miles an hour, that's enough to put a ding in your side panel.
Roofing codes like they do in Wyoming.
Oh yeah, the roofing business here is huge. If they get a good hailstorm coming through, the roofing guys, you know, the crews are out, and they come through neighborhoods, and you know, have guys, their inspectors come through first who say, yeah, we looked at your roof, we could see your roof, looks like it might have some hail damage, and we can get you a new roof with your insurance company. And so they sweep through. And here's something interesting. You see these guys come out, and of course their work crews are almost all you know, immigrant labor, and they've stopped coming around quite so much these days. So
is that good?
I think it is good, because it was clear to, you know, this employment lawyer that most of this workforce was probably being paid sub federal wage levels. My understanding is they weren't being paid by the hour; they're being paid by the roof. And so, or being paid by the job. And so that violates federal wage law, which means that if you're using, you know, if you're trying to abide by the law, the federal wage and hour law and the state wage and hour law, you can't compete with these guys. So, you know, that's a pipeline for illegals coming in, depressing wage levels. And that's what was happening. So I think it is a good thing. I think we'll start seeing people who are complying with the wage and hour law coming back up now.
Why is that against the law?
Because when you pay them by the job, you're almost always paying less than the federal mandated wage rate or the city mandated wage rate here in Denver. So
you dudes that are anti all these people. And you know, we have a lot on the show. And Anti used to live in Chicago. That's not happening here at all. I'm not at all debating the fact whether people are citizens or not. When they put the roof on our place, they had There was probably 8-9 guys. And
yeah, it's at least, we had our roof replaced a couple of years ago, and it was at least that many.
But I mean, it's a big job.
Yeah.
And the job was, you know, it took them a day and a few hours. I mean, they were, what, Lou, so friggin' hot. First thing these guys did at 8 o'clock was start hauling all this stuff up this ladder before it got beastly hot. And I was asking the guy how they did the business. He goes, well, if we get the job, if anybody, there's like 3 or 4 of us that'll actually get jobs. But then everybody works in everybody else's building, everybody else's roof. So if the roof is like 11 grand, which ours was, or 12 or whatever it was, as the guy who books it gets like 2 shares, and everybody else gets $1,200. How is that illegal?
Well, how many hours did they work?
8 or 9, and then a couple the next day. 10, well, maybe, I mean, they're making $100 an hour.
If that's the case, then that's fine. But that's not typically what happens.
Well, the labor is so short here in Chicago. You look at people, and they look okay. They look like they're not citizens, whatever the hell that means. You ask how much they're making. They're making union wage. You can't get anybody here that is somewhat. If your air conditioning guy has a helper, it's not like he's paying to do $10 an hour. It's not happening here. The labor is so short. The skilled labor is so short.
No, I know that, and I'm, what I'm saying is that there are a whole bunch of requirements. If you're a lawful employer and you're employing people legally, who can sue you if you're not doing it, you're not following the requirements. There are requirements with respect to payroll, records keeping, tax withholdings, the whole bit, and many of these guys that use illegal immigrants for labor don't follow any of that stuff. So they basically, their overhead costs drop dramatically.
I'm sure people would like to do it, and I think people used to do it. I'm just saying, here, I don't think you can do it. One of my clients, unfortunately, just passed. I was in a, I won't say what kind of business, was in a business where he did a lot of stuff for commercial places, and he goes, people want to pay me cash. I can't take cash.
Right.
Well, he says, I could, but I can't pay people in cash. Nobody wants that anymore.
That's not the case here.
Okay.
And I will tell you that if you want to see a good marker of the underground economy, you know, and by that I mean the economy that's not paying federal taxes, that's not paying wages and record keeping adequately, so we don't have a clear picture of what the workforce looks like, go to a Costco or a Sam's Club and stand in line with somebody who's got 5 baskets full of groceries and whatnot, and who pulls a wad of $100 bills out of their pocket and pays solely in $100 bills. And, okay. And I see that.
I'd love to be that guy. Nobody knows what I was buying.
That's right. Every time I go to Costco, I see that, you know, there's 2 or 3 people in front of me, and you know, my assumption, because nobody in their right mind walks around with $1,000 in $100 bills in their pocket.
Oh, I'd love to if I had some.
My assumption is, yeah, but you wouldn't walk around with them.
Sure, I would.
Why would you? Why would you? Okay, well, I don't say that on the air.
I said I wouldn't. Why would I? Why would I not want to?
Crime. For one thing, and okay. you could be robbed. You could lose it. It could be misplaced.
Well, now they could just put a gun in my head and take me to a cash station. What's the difference?
Well, there's a big difference, and you know you know that, but when you see this cash economy running, and I know you're a big push guy for cash. I get it, and I know why. It makes sense, but most people don't operate that way. And if you see this kind of these kinds of payments going on, you say, okay, well, there's a substantial underground economy that's running only on cash that is designed to evade federal and state regulatory requirements. And I don't like the federal and state regulatory requirements. I think they're excessive. I think our minimum wage thing has gone off the rails. But if we're gonna require people to follow these legal restrictions, the companies that don't do that have a decided competitive advantage, and that's what you see here.
I don't know what
the arrangements are in
yeah, I'm
Chicago.
Saying it's nowhere near, because right now if you don't you can walk up with a lot of cash, you can't rent an apartment. Some people want to see paychecks for 3 times the amount of the rent. If somebody just pays you in cash unless you like lived with your brother or something, I don't think you could even exist. You can't rent a car. You can't. What can you do?
I get that, and that's a function. That's a function of our culture gradually moving from a high trust society to a low trust society. And if you look at some of the scams that are running these days with regard to, for example, rental cars, it's probably no surprise that the company says, okay, fine, I'm not gonna rent to somebody with cash because I don't know what's gonna happen to my vehicle. I want to be able to, and I can't trace the guy. I want to be able if something happens to the vehicle, because I've had lots of things happen to our vehicles. I want to be able to trace the guy with a credit card.
Yeah, I don't. No, there's a, speaking of which, Lou, there's a guy, kind of a character, works for one of these mortgage firms. I see once in a while if I stop downstairs, and the dude is a, he says, you know, if they fire me, they don't care. He goes, I can get another job tomorrow. And I go, where can you get another job tomorrow? You know what the guy is? He was a repossessor.
A repo man.
Yeah. You know, okay. You know what's even weirder is my significant other. She used to work for when she got out of college. She was working for this car rental company, and part of the job was every week they had to go out and people won't bring the rental cars back. You had to go repossess the rental car. She's like 24 years old. She's going out with a guy and repossessing a car. One guy was the what the hell was the guy doing? They followed him someplace. He came flying out of the house with a knife, and he was chasing the guy around the car or something. So, she jumped in and drove it off. they made people go repossess cars from the rental car agency. You had to go do it as part of your job.
Yeah,
I never knew that.
In one of my previous jobs with a large Chicago-centric unnamed law firm, they had a high-end bankruptcy practice. And bankruptcy practice is, you know, big bucks if you're dealing with corporate America, and this was a very profitable niche for this firm. But an element of that practice was high-end repossessions, and the attorneys that practiced in that area, as a matter of course, required the associates to go out on some of these calls to see what it was like to get involved here, so they had a feel for what was actually happening on the ground when their guys went out to take stuff back. And, you know, so one of the guys was repossessing some high-end supercar, you know, like a Ferrari, you know, $300,000 car, like a Countach or something like that. And he got shot at. The guy came out of the house as they were, and I said, do you break into the car? And he said, well, the dealer in this case, I think it was a leased car, like you said, the dealer had a separate set of keys. So once we got to the car, we could get into it without having to damage it. One guy went out and they repossessed like a 727 from some sheik or something like that. It was parked at an airfield in Wisconsin that the guy had just basically abandoned there. With a security, some kind of security arrangement in a hangar. They did have to break in, you know, in the middle of the night, cut the locks on the hangar. And I said, do the local authorities like object to this? And he said, we almost never, tell the local authorities what we're doing. Sometimes we do. I mean,
how do you fire up a plane? And how do you know things even airworthy?
I don't know how they got it out of there. I know that they cut the locks on the hangar. They had to cut the locks on the hangar door, pull it out, then get, you know, a tow vehicle. I assume that they bribed the security team so that there was no problem with those guys. I just assume they paid them off and then came in, hooked up the plane, towed it out, and then had a crew gas it up and take it off. But yeah, so those are in the law. There are interesting stories, and that kind of practice is one of they took. I think he said they went into Bimini or some island in the Caribbean, and repossess some, $10 million cigarette boat that had belonged to some drug cartel that they ended up getting title to, and they had to get a team in there to take it out. And these guys had great stories. So
those are better than one that we had. A guy who showed up for one of the seminars that we used to help with. This back in the 90s, when there was a time where people actually wanted to learn how to trade the market, learn about options, learn about futures and stuff, where they actually would spend a week doing it. Now nobody wants to learn anything. They just want somebody to tell them what to buy or whatever, or your job is to buy the best stocks or something. It's a little crazier. It's different, let's put it that way. And I'm talking to the guy, and he brings his wife's there too, and I don't know, she didn't really come to any classes. And I go, "What are you doing?" The guy says, "Well, I'm a car dealer." I go, "Really?" And this was just when they started doing the signal where the people know where your car is all the time and stuff. This is why I like driving old trucks. I don't want any of that stuff.
OnStar GPS.
Well, he says, we used to just, if people didn't pay their bills, we used to turn the car off. I said, what if you're in traffic? He goes, "Well, that was a problem." It got to be a problem. He says, then we figured out a way we'd only turn it off when it was in park. So I go, "Okay, well, when you say about the keys, if you have the VIN number now, you get the key." I mean, it's really hard to go to the Ace Hardware and get the key made for these new cars. You got to go to the dealer and you need the VIN number. So he goes, "Yeah, we come out, my wife and I, if there's some place that we want to go, like Chicago, so we can write off the trip, we find a car that's, is in Chicago that needs to be repossessed, and we come out and we have the keys and we go and we drive the car home." You got to be bleeping me. and that way we can write off the trip, we get our car back. And I'm going, I suppose if it's on a street in Lincoln Park, you can pull that off. I'm not so sure you want to go to a driveway in Inglewood and do that with your wife with you.
There's some videos out there of these guys that do rapid repo. They drive along and they've got this automated system where they literally just back up. It's all hydraulic. They just back up to the car, shove the thing under the front end or the back end, and it just lifts one half of the car straight up in the air and locks it down, and then they just drive off. It's pretty funny.
Well, when you used to put the the hook on the car and all that stuff, you don't do that anymore. You just put the thing. You take it on one side of the tire and shove it on the other side. You pick it up by the tires and off you go. Anyway, what's the word in the Middle East? I think Trump's timing was pretty good. I think both sides are pretty tired at this point.
Well,
not mentally, but money or munition wise.
I think the Israelis, the limiting factor for the Israelis, I think, was their interceptors that could guard and protect their their cities and military establishments, because the Iranians were gradually wearing that down. On the other hand, Iran, the circumstance or the problem in dealing with a bunch of theocratic, autocratic, apocalyptic, murderous thugs in a regime, or leading a regime, is that they can't say we surrender. Because that means God's hand is not with them, and they can't admit that. So, the minute Israel stopped shooting, the Iranians start putting out press releases saying they had to stop because we were about to destroy them.
Oh yeah. Well.
I'm hopeful that the ceasefire will hold. I think the Israelis have said, look, we've done enough damage to these guys. For Israel, it's whack-a-mole over there now. They were whacking the Gaza mole, and then they whacked the Hezbollah mole, and now they're whacked the Iranian mole, and they've whacked all those moles, and now it's time to go back to, they've now got to go back to the Hamas mole and whack it now, because Hamas just issued a statement saying, we're not giving up any hostages until there's a total ceasefire, a total withdrawal from Gaza. And it's very much like the Black Knight in Monty Python, if you remember that scene where the King Arthur character cuts the guy's arm off, and the Black Knight in King Arthur goes, "Now surrender," and the Black Knight goes, "Ha, a mere flesh wound, I've had worse." And he ends up he ends up chopping off the both arms and both legs off, and the Black Knight is sitting there, this, you know, basically a stump. And King Arthur goes, I'm leaving now. And the Black Knight goes, okay, we'll call it a draw.
Well,
I mean that's basically what you've got going. So from Israel's perspective, fine, we'll stop with we've done enough damage to Iran. We own the air over the country. We've decimated their military leadership. We've destroyed their political intelligence group. We've cratered a bunch of their runway so their fighters can't take off. We've destroyed 60-70% of their missile launching capability. And we have unequivocally demonstrated to this region and the world that the United States is on our side and is willing to use its military power in certain circumstances to assist us. So that's enough for us for right now. Now we can turn our attention to Gaza and what I hope will be the bulldozing of that area down to dirt. And
everybody dead?
No. They're refugees. They can be moved. The Gazans are all refugees. They've retained refugee status. They don't live in Gaza. It's not a permanent place for them. They can be moved. I don't care.
Put them here.
Put them in a tent city in the Sinai, or go to start exporting them. I mean, they are moving. The Gazans are being moved, and I'm not sure whether it's through Israel or some Arab coalition, but are being moved piecemeal out to places like Indonesia and some other predominantly Muslim countries. But I just, you know, the short answer is Hamas, which is still in firm control in Gaza, is not going to give up the hostages. They can't. It doesn't matter what Israel does. Gaza has to hold hostages because they have to have that that piece of Israel in their, you know, in their hands.
There can't be too many of them left alive.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I know.
You know, from the Gaza knows that the Hamas knows that the Israelis are from a cultural and religious mindset, fully dedicated to getting the bodies back, you know, the people back, the bodies back. And until that happens, that's a cudgel with which Hamas can beat the Israeli leadership. And that's what they want to do. So, you know, my take on this is fine. We tried the experiment of letting them, you know, letting those folks run their own enclave. They ran it into the ground. I like Trump's initial suggestion that we basically take the place over. We move the people out. As I said, they're officially refugees, which means they don't have a permanent residence there. We officially move the people out, put them somewhere else.
To where? Not here. We don't have anybody here.
Put them in the middle of the Sinai. Put them in a barbed wire tent city in the Sinai. And
all tens of thousands of people.
Well, millions, right? It's what, a million?
Okay, well, it's a little harsh.
It is, but you know, they brought this, culture brought it on itself. I mean, Gaza needs to be fully occupied, taken apart. The tunnels need to be filled with seawater or concrete. And they need to segregate those folks out. If they move all of them out of there, they get facial recognition on all of them, and they start figuring out who's the bad guys and who aren't. And those guys they imprison, and the rest of the population are put in another place.
Why didn't we do that with Germany and Japan? Just kill everybody and start over.
We didn't because I'm not saying they should kill everybody, and we did segregate out the bad guys.
I understand that, but we didn't.
And we summarily executed.
We had people that were intelligent enough to realize that if you leave places a cesspool, it just happens all over again.
Well, that's why I'm saying we've already tried the cesspool approach. The Israelis have already tried the cesspool approach. It didn't work.
They moved people out and shoved them in a place, and as long as they weren't looking at them, they didn't care what happened. Baca Valley, other place. I don't know what's going to happen in Syria. What's going to happen?
The Baca Valley was never occupied by Israel, and it was Syrian territory, and it stayed Syrian territory.
What I'm saying is they push people there, and now all of a sudden, I'm saying we've got Lebanon a bleep hole, we got Syria a bleep hole, we got Gaza.
You know where's not a bleep hole is Jordan, and you know why?
Well, the guy has more refugees than he does people.
No.
And we don't want anybody here.
No, the Jordanians ran all the Palestinians out of the country. And I should say Gazans, but whatever you want to call them. They ran all those people out of the country. You know why? Because they tried to foment revolution and overthrow the king. And so the Jordanians said, we're not screwing around here. That's what Black September is, by the way, September 1967. The Jordanians said, we've had enough of this. We are driving all of you out. And they did. They executed a bunch of Palestinian leadership and drove the rest out of the country and said, you're not welcome back here. And that pretty much is the lesson for the rest of the Arab countries in the Middle East. Nobody wants these folks.
But they have, how many refugees does Jordan have of people they do want? I don't know, but I think the place, last time I checked, boy, I should check this again for it. I think the country has like 4 million people, and I think they've got like 2.5 million refugees.
In Jordan?
Yeah.
I don't believe that's right.
I mean, the numbers are probably awful. But I'll check them by next week. But
okay.
But no, I mean, everybody says they should go somewhere. The question is where.
Well, as I said, Gaza is. I would basically communicate that Gaza is kaput. We're not going to allow anybody in Gaza except for, you know, Israeli settlers and the rest of you folks. Since you love your refugee status, we're going to treat you like refugees, which means we're moving you, and we'll put you somewhere else. And I, you know, Israel should be able to negotiate with. I mean, they can go. If I were them, I'd go back to Syria and say, "Do you want these folks? You know, because we're going to take them out of here." And
I actually read a thing, and of course, you read this by everybody. You never know if it's right or not. So this guy traced the history of the Israel area for how many centuries he went back, and I'm not advocating this. I'm just lobbing it out there. He said for long periods of time, the Israelis and whatever else used to live in the area, lived together pretty peacefully.
Yep. Well, there were pogroms that were pretty bad in the late 19th and 20th centuries.
I mean, he's going back to 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, everything. The idea that the place has to be purely Jewish, everybody else has to leave. He goes, where did that come from?
Well, it's not that way. And Israel has a substantial Arab population that gets to vote, that has representatives in their parliament. The Arabs living in Israel have more rights than Arabs almost anywhere else in the Middle East.
Well, you know, I don't want anybody doing any kind of violence to anybody. You and I agree on 90% of the stuff. I look at the economic area. I mean, it doesn't surprise me the way Germany was left after World War One. It just was a question of what the guy's name was going to be. Same way with Italy, same way. And you see, anytime there's economic hardship, how people all of a sudden behave pretty weird. I mean, anybody who doesn't think that it's somewhat happening here.
So what's the economic hardship in Gaza?
What do you think the unemployment rate is in males 18 to 35? 50%?
That's totally irrelevant.
And you know it isn't.
Yes, it is. You know why? Because billions of dollars are funneled into Gaza to support that place with no job for their people.
The problem with economic forecasting, Lou, is you can see trends and you can make predictions. It doesn't mean that the people who do the nasty stuff are right and shouldn't go to jail or all those kinds of things or be executed or whatever you want to do to them. I'm just saying one includes the other. My brother did
I was going to say the problem with economic forecasting is it's often wrong.
Well, no, it's not. It's never wrong. The behavioral economic forecasting is never wrong. When I say it's never wrong, my brother traces this stuff because he used to trade. He's now president of PTI, but he used to trade corn options, right? So he always follows that in worldwide prices. You look at the Arab Spring, and I couldn't tell you when or where or who or what the guy's name was. My brother will tell you what at the time. Virtually everybody out of the Western countries made like $5 a day. That's what you make in all these places, and on average, and that's it's a big average. And at one point, the price of grain, essentially to eat porridge or what the hell you're eating, the basic food, got over $5 a day. And in the next 6 months, you had the Arab Spring. You had problems in every single country. Now, could you predict who the guy was who was going to cause the trouble? Could you predict something? whenever you have these kinds of economic things, I mean, I can't tell you who
here's,
the guys.
Here's my take. Almost always in my experience, that's hindsight. Somebody goes back and looks and says, there's a trend.
That's because you're not, this isn't your area. You can anticipate stuff happening on the law side. I can anticipate stuff happening on the economic side. I mean, if all of a sudden, I mean, in this country right now.
No, I'm sorry. I mean the correlation between things like this that you've just described.
My brother said this is whenever you get, and he went back in history, whenever you get, virtually most of the planet can't eat during the day. Stuff, it's always somebody's getting all the money, so there's always some kind of revolution.
I'm sure that's correct. I'm not arguing with that. I'm saying that there was no problem with people not being able to eat in Gaza. They had plenty of money. They had plenty of food. It wasn't optimal.
A day in the life of a Gaza guy. Where do you go to work, Lou? I read the unemployment rate.
And
18 to 35 males was pushing 50%. That is absolutely a cause for. You don't know what's going to happen, but it's a problem.
If that meant that they were starving, you're absolutely right. But that's not what was happening. There was plenty of money for all kinds of things. And the population was not starving. Was it a glamour spot? No, but they had plenty of money to build an infrastructure that would be the envy of any mining company anywhere in the world. All of that money went into the thing that is driving Gaza in its leadership is the fact that there are still Jews alive in the neighborhood. That's their animating motivation.
I can't debate that, but what you just said, Lou, it's akin to saying the unemployment rate in Inglewood among males 16 to 35 is 50%, but don't worry about it, they all got food stamps. That doesn't cut it with me.
What I'm saying is that the normal economic push for revolution or revolt that you're addressing is not the same when you have billions of free money pouring into that place, supporting it, keeping it viable in the sense that people aren't starving to death. They were living, you know, perfectly acceptable lives. They had an extended infrastructure. Was it something that we would have found suitable? No, but by regional standards, it wasn't bad, and yet that was not enough. That money, a huge chunk of it, got diverted into military projects because the animating point of that culture is to destroy Israel and destroy Jews.
I'm not arguing any of that stuff. What I'm saying is, you look at the you don't have to look over there. Just look at some of the areas here.
My point. We don't have an area comparable to that here.
Although maybe
New York City's about to turn that way.
We have the same sort of thing when people aren't working, have nothing to do, and look at people who seem to be taking all the money. You don't show up and flip some guy a McDonald's quarter pounder and say everything's okay. I mean, why do you think there's stress in this country? Because 5% of the people got all the money. And the 5% of the people who got the money say, what's the problem? He's okay.
We may have a chicken and egg, a little bit of a chicken and egg situation here. My point is that it doesn't matter that the fact that these guys had a 35 or 40% unemployment rate, because the economy was being funded externally and was viable. Now, I agree with you that having a bunch of young men running around with nothing to do is a very volatile situation. But I'm not sure that, you know, the desire to attack Israel or kill Jews arises out of the economic circumstance. My position is the desire to destroy Israel and kill Jews predates the economic condition of that culture.
You're absolutely correct.
And is the motivating factor, and the only way that Israel is going to be safe from the craziness that exists there is to basically take the people out of that area where they've established an infrastructure for terrorism, take them out of that area, remove them, put them somewhere else, take over that area, the Gaza Strip, demilitarize it. And I mean, if they want to put them back in there, well, eventually, fine.
Erasing the place definitely is a solution. Well, I'm saying, Louis, I'm not agreeing with the Hamas people, but I'm not surprised that they got elected, is all I'm saying.
Okay, well, my point is the craziness, the anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic craziness predates the economic misery and actually is a cause
of
it.
What does every dictator do to people that are crazy people like that? What do they do to get power? They find themselves somebody who's the problem. I mean, did anybody in Germany...
No. See, I disagree. I think this issue predates
anything
to deal with the Nakba or the displacement of the Palestinians from Israeli
territory.
We're kind
of talking about, I mean, people have to define an enemy. And Hamas says the reason why we're here is because of Israel. Or else we would be them and they would be us. I don't know what the message is, but the message is falling on people. I mean, look at what happened in Germany, Lou. Did the people who lived in Germany really know that the Jewish dentist down the block was actually their enemy and the source of all their problems until Hitler told them it was and they believed him?
I don't think, but that's a different circumstance.
Well, but look what's going on here. There are people that never even saw a migrant. They're absolutely convinced that the reason why they're not making more money, that the reason why their life isn't better is because of people they never met. There are enemies here, and you never even met one.
You don't have to meet people to know they're your enemy. When they express it.
What I'm saying, the amount of everybody here feels they're absolutely being stolen from by people they never even met. Did anybody even know those people are their enemies until Trump told us they were?
Yes.
Who?
Well, I mean, in the sense, the impact of illegal immigration was pretty well known.
By who? I mean, he's upped it by 100 times.
You're an economist. Were you not paying attention to the economists who were talking about what was happening?
I've never been a fan of people who, you know, pile in and no border controls and those kinds of that. You know that. But it has been revved up in terms of how much it affects you.
Well, that's because we've imported, 10 million
people? Make it 100 million. If Trump says it's 100 million tomorrow, are you going to believe him?
I know roughly what the numbers are, what I see are the official numbers. We've brought 10 million people in the last 10 years into places that can't handle them. I see the impact here. In Chicago, the impact probably isn't nearly as bad because you don't have as many, you have a lot more people and a lot more of a diverse economic front. Here in Denver, it's a little bit different. It's a much more concentrated economic zone. And to dump 10% of your population, dump a population of people who are here without the ability to get jobs, without the ability to...
All right, we have 330 million people here.
Drop them into that area, you know, with no, you know, notice is a huge impact. And come on, these are economists doing forecasting, right? You're not arguing with their numbers.
I'm absolutely arguing with the number. What you just said was, I don't believe the 10 million people that came flying in here, that none of them were, none of them had any business being here. I don't believe that at all. But I'd say the number is less than that. We have 330 million people here. How does 10 million into 330 million become 10%? Sounds like 3% to me.
It's local impact. But you put these people in. So here in Denver, dumping roughly 50,000. Illegal immigrants into the economy is a huge slam in a city with a population of less than 500,000, and that's a big number. The number that I've seen, and I'm going off of my last recollection of official numbers, is somewhere between 15 and 20 million people are here illegally.
I've been doing some research on this. Now, what does that mean?
That are here illegally?
Yeah.
Means they're here without proper authorization from our immigration laws.
What percentage of those people, because I happen to know a whole bunch of them, and I'm not going to say who the hell they are.
No.
Some of them were here 30 years ago on a student visa and stayed. and have had a job and a bank account and been working here and have a family and a house and the whole bit.
Okay, great.
Now, are they my enemy?
None of these people are your quote enemy. They're just lawbreakers. And when
and who's
dump,
the biggest beneficiary of that, Lou?
Well, I would say they are the biggest. They're the biggest.
How about the government that's been taking their Social Security money for the last 15, 20, 30 years and has no intention of ever paying them?
No, I would say that they are the biggest beneficiary of that. Otherwise, they would leave.
Okay, so
otherwise they wouldn't come here. I'm not going to get into a moral argument with you. The short answer is, this issue, illegal immigration, is a huge issue. And it's a huge problem in these communities where these folks have been either dumped or arrive, and they overwhelm social services. And they're, you know, we have an immigration law system that is supposedly set up to regulate this, and it's not being enforced until now, and it's a huge issue for a significant, well, the majority of the population in the country, voting population.
Okay,
this is what they voted for.
Here's nobody knows what they voted for, Lou. People keep saying that to me on the show. They voted against the other lady. They didn't vote for any idea that Trump comes out of his head tomorrow.
I voted for some specific things that Trump said he wanted to do.
Oh, I get that. All right. And I have some of the stuff he's done I actually really like.
Close the border.
All right. What I'm saying is, look at... I know that I'm an anachronism when I do this. Look at the numbers.
What happened, Tom? It was just easier.
Okay,
it's easy to say they voted against Harris because she was such a terrible candidate, and it certainly made voting for Trump a lot easier for a lot of people. I get it, but that's not why a large number of people voted for Trump. And if you think that it was just an anti-Harris vote, I suggest you.
For some percentage of the population. They love the style. They love people, him swearing at people and calling people idiots.
Some of the stuff that was coming out after we bombed Iran. I read some of the stuff that was coming out from some of the, I guess you can call them far right wing. I call them more libertarian supporters of Donald Trump, who said, "I didn't vote for this. This is another forever war. You know, I don't want any part of
this."
There's some very specific reasons people voted for Trump.
I happen to think that his timing on this, with both sides wearying to a certain extent, and I think you agree with me on that, the timing on this to saying enough, I don't think it's going to stop people hating each other, but I think it could put things back in somewhat order for 5 to 10 years, which is pretty damn good when you think about it. What I'm saying, don't let these guys do the number creep on you. Okay, the number creep is we have people that have got over the border recently illegally. And should that happen? No, we're agreeing on that.
Millions.
We also have not that many millions. And we also have
not that many millions.
Let me make my point, please. What I'm saying is if you jump from that number, which is probably a couple of million, if you jump from that number to all the people here who should have gone home 40 years ago on a student... By the way, you know who was big on that? You know who never left on a student visa? It was Musk. We gonna kick him out too?
Yeah. I'm gonna say this. I don't know what Mr. Musk's immigration status is, but my understanding is he's a green card holder. So he at least took the steps to get naturalized. You know, I'm sorry. Here's what's gonna happen. A certain political party said, you know what? We don't have enough voters, so we're going to import.
I don't buy that at all.
I know you don't, but just bear with me.
They're not that smart.
We're going to allow millions and millions and millions of illegals to come across the border into our neighborhoods, and we're gonna import them, and we're gonna drop them in places that have absolutely no ability to sustain this.
Careful.
No, wait.
I know the people that I know are here illegally all voted for Trump.
Okay. Well, they better not be voting if they're here illegally.
Why is it so hard for somebody to get citizenship? I'd love to see that number too. Okay.
Which, by the way, goes to my point.
The cleaning lady of the person next door to me, who's been here for 25 years, pays taxes, has a bank account, has a car, donates her time to her church. She's not my enemy.
I'm just saying, this situation went completely out of control under the last administration. It was a conscious decision to open the border and allow millions of people to come into the country illegally. The pendulum swinging back, because that happened, the pendulum swinging back now is not going to look very nice. They are going to sweep up, you know, it's going to be like the gentle rain that falleth from heaven on the just and the unjust. And they are going to sweep up everybody that's here because the voters demand a solution, and we don't have
the voters are demanding the cleaning lady get picked up.
The voters are demanding that the illegal immigrant population in this country be removed, or be at least be cleared.
What voter is demanding that? There isn't anybody that they picked up a lady last week here in Chicago. They sent her a notice to come for her citizenry was being advanced. They picked her up and took her someplace nobody knows where, and she's got a 6-year-old at home.
Yep,
it's a mess. You tell me anybody who voted for this guy to do that. There's nobody voted for that. I don't know.
I'm just telling you, the circumstances that have been set by the previous administration with the number of people that have been brought in here make it impossible to go on a case-by-case basis. You're going to have to engage in a mass...
Anybody who doesn't look like us gets thrown out.
You're going to engage in a mass enforcement. It's going to catch...
Why?
It's going to catch the guys from Eastern Europe. It's going to catch the guys from...
Why? Why are we doing
from
this?
Central America. Because our economy is in a mess, and because this is a...
Anybody who thinks that the people who are going to work every day are causing the economy a problem, why is that?
Because we are not seeing assimilation on the part of these populations. Instead, we're seeing a separate entity. We are watching mass demonstrations in support of our enemies in places like New York, Washington, D.C., L.A., We're seeing huge poverty issues, and whether it's all attributable to mass immigration or illegal immigration, I don't know.
But we have
gotten to a point where the only answer is a large scale program like this, and when you do that, as you know,
so you want to deport 30 million people?
No, wait a minute. Whose numbers are bad now?
Whatever Trump number makes up. Why do people scrutinize my numbers and they believe him?
Well, okay. So
you just went from we just went from a couple.
2008.
You're saying
before I left Chicago, in 2008 or 10, this thing boiled up under Obama, and Obama said we get too many illegal people here. This thing boiled up, and the estimate then was 13 million people here illegally in the United States, and that was then. And my understanding is there have been at least another 10 million coming across the border illegally, unvetted, since then. So that's where my number comes from. I don't know where 30 million comes from, but are we going to mass deport 30 million? I don't know. But are we going to deport the people that we can locate? Yes, we are. And as I said, this was a deliberate attempt to flood the country with people who were here illegally to such an extent that removing them is impossible unless you engage in this kind of wholesale activity. And that's what's happening now.
The total U.S. population is 335 million people, of which roughly 87% are either native-born citizens or naturalized citizens, which leaves you about 13% that are not citizens right now.
So that's 33 million?
Okay, now some of them are students, some of them have cards, some of them have been here forever working, some of them
have been in the...
Why is it so hard to become a citizen?
You have to ask the immigration people and petition Congress to change that over. I'm just saying that, this what is happening right now was a deliberate move to flood the system with so many people that it would be impossible to correct it and set it back.
And then
to wave a magic wand and make them all citizens so that they could vote.
I was having
breakfast. And guess who the guys that were enabling this thought they were going to vote for?
That is, I can't even go there with that one, but I will mention you this the other day. I was having
this is a matter of record.
I can't even begin to go there on that one.
I know you can't because you can't envision that.
How the hell is how's a guy going to vote?
Conspiratorial thinking. I'm sorry.
How does a guy come flying across, swimming across the thing? The last thing on his mind is voting.
Name me
somebody who swam across the river 6 months ago that somehow made it to a polling place.
I'm not sure what your point is.
You're saying that they brought him here to make him vote.
No. I'm saying that this was done with an idea that it would be impossible to correct the problem, and then you would naturalize the solution. Then, if it's impossible to remove these folks, and enforce our immigration laws. The solution then is to naturalize all of them, which would be the next step in the legislative process, to put in a naturalization law that makes all these people citizens magically, with no residency requirements or anything else. You're living here, you're now a citizen, and bang, once that happens, then you're eligible to vote.
I was having breakfast with a guy the other day last week. This older dude, he was helping Audrey watch her dogs. She was out of town, so. Me being the nice guy.
This is a matter of record.
There's a guy sitting next to his table listening to the conversation. He gets up. He goes, "You mind if I chime in?" I said, "No." He's a Hispanic dude. I'm going to say he's 50-ish. And he says, "I was a Marine for quite a while. And then I was, because I was born here. My parents, because it took them forever to get their citizenship. I don't know why. They were applying right away and everything. And they got here legally." So my son is now. What's the story now, Louie? They have these like pre-camps from the Marines where you go to camps like locally before you even enter basing training. What's that all about? But anyway, there's one here like in Chicago Heights. He goes, my son is there, and the parents get to go out and visit and so forth. So I go out there and he's got two buddies, and one of the buddies talking to me and the recruiting guy. Now the kid I think might have been born here. His parents are not citizens. So the recruiting guy is a way to entice the kid to join the Marines, tells him, we'll put your parents on the fast track if you join up. And the guy goes, I said, wait a minute, I wouldn't believe that for a second. He goes, well, neither did I. So I go back and I actually find the guy. And I say, look, I'm an ex-Marine. What are you telling this kid to get him in here? And he goes, well, my supervisor said, yeah, we're putting the parents on the fast track. They've been here for 30 years, Lou.
Good.
There's no fast track. They're just BS are giving the kid.
Well, I would love to think because I'm aware of situations where we have guys who have served on active duty and who did not get their citizenship status as a result.
Yeah, well, how does that work?
Which I think is out. I don't like it. I think it's outrageous. But I don't know. I don't know enough about the process to be able to tell you this is what they should be doing. I do know that when we were having recruiting woes in the 80s and 90s, that we offered citizenship vouchers to foreign nationals who would come and join the armed forces who were living here, residents here, and that was a way to become a citizen, and I think that should be automatic. If you volunteer to serve, you're in. And I don't know why that's not being done. But the idea that you could come in and say, okay, you're going to put your life on the line for the country, your parents stable, they're here illegally for whatever reason, fine. We have an expedited system that would allow them to accelerate and get them into the green card process and get them to do that. This is something they should have done. This is what drives me crazy. All of this should have been done when these folks came in, when they had the shortfall, when they overstayed the student visa, when whatever. Instead, we culturally turned a blind eye to this stuff. We allowed people to use phony Social Security numbers. Back up.
What do you mean by use them?
I mean, they stole they have phony social security numbers. We allow that to happen.
All right, now, the people on the right here, Kevin's texting me as we go. Look at the numbers, Lou. Who does that benefit exactly?
It benefits them, Tom. That's why
Where does the money go?
What money?
What do you mean? If I hired one of those guys, the money, that person for 40 years is going to send a check to the government every friggin' week.
It benefits, the government gets, I'm sure, some benefit out of it if it's not going to
pay
that number.
They get everybody's contribution.
But the benefit, these people are not, victims. They're benefiting from this. They have false Social Security numbers so that they can be issued paychecks.
All right, and what comes out of the paycheck?
So taxes come out of the paycheck. So the government gets some minor benefit. Right, you ask me who benefits.
I'm telling you benefits. Now, why when Musk and the Doge guys went into the Social Security, why don't they come out and say, hey, here's a Social Security number. We don't recognize the number. Let's call Lou's Cafe and say that guy is, and send the money back. They don't do that. And when the guy gets to be 65, guess what? He doesn't get paid. I mean, who's benefited from that?
So what's your point?
My point is, you're saying a person with the false Social Security, I mean, it's not like if it's false, the check doesn't clear. There were people who, years ago, when
I
started doing this.
There
were all kinds of people whose their Social Security number was all ones. All right?
I don't like the idea that there are millions of people apparently earning paychecks here with false Social Security numbers that, I don't like the idea that they're paying into the system and not getting any recompense.
Why doesn't the system call somebody up and say this is a fake number? They just take the check.
Well, and that's an issue for real valid criticism, and I go after this administration like I have every other one that does not mandate the use of something called E-Verify, which is an electronic digital tracking system for Social Security numbers and I-9 registrations so that employers can ensure that they are not employing people illegally. And this administration, just like every other one, has not come down and said, you must use it.
What makes you think, Lou, what makes you think that everybody that's been in office for the last 32 years, what makes you think that every one of them doesn't like the fact that, say there's 40 million fake Social Security cards out there. What makes you think they don't like the fact that they're getting 40 million checks every week and have no intention of paying these people?
I don't know if they have no intention of paying these.
Yeah, they are. You don't get paid if you're not a citizen. You can't. How do you apply for it?
My point is this: that's bad. That should be corrected. I fault the administration for not doing it because a significant mechanism for dealing with the illegal immigration problem is to simply tell the employers you can't hire these folks, and all those jobs disappear.
You pay Medicare for 30 years, and guess what? You're not covered. That's cool, isn't it?
It doesn't. I don't care about that.
Well,
I mean, that's,
you would if it was your dad.
I don't like it. I don't like it. But my point is, if we're really going to get serious about this, rather than just sweeping up people and deporting them, we ought to make it so that they can't get jobs. And that would deal with a significant.
Well,
the other issue
is for somebody who's been here a long time. Why not just make them a citizen?
Because they haven't followed the rules.
What makes you think they haven't been? I happen to know somebody who even got married once to try and do it. She's been here 30 years. She's been trying to become a citizen the whole way. Can't do it. I mean, I can't speak to
individual anecdotes. I know that it's much easier to try to get us. Yeah,
we'd rather just believe that everybody's an enemy and they're all screwed up. We got to do it all.
No, they're not enemies. They're here illegally. And like I said, the situation has developed to such a point deliberately that it's going to be impossible to fix it without the kind of occasional and in some cases widespread systematic injustice that you're talking about.
So that our only we have to dash here, but our only solution is to be unjust to make up for something.
Oh no, the solution that the preferred solution that the people who designed this program want is wholesale naturalization. we wave the magic wand and turn all these people into citizens. That's the solution that the people who designed this system want to have happen.
I'm not so sure I want that, but I would like to have somebody who wants to become one. If you look at them, you thought they were for 20 years. Why not? I mean,
the perfect is the enemy of the good. I'd love for that system to happen too. I'd love for us to catch and bless every guy who was here illegally, or woman who was here illegally, who was in the armed forces. I don't know why that doesn't happen.
Oh, well, that's a general amnesty. We don't want that.
Well, it's not a general amnesty if it's in exchange for federal service.
All right.
So why that isn't being done, I don't know.
It hasn't been done for a long time. I mean, why not is the question. I mean, I don't know. I refuse to believe. I'm not going to have somebody in Washington open his big mouth and tell me that person's my enemy. I refuse to believe it.
But they're not. I don't think anybody's saying enemy.
Bull. It went from people who swam
point
over
me to,
illegal.
Point me to a statement where Trump or any of his people have said these people are the enemy.
It's another whole subject. S&P futures up 20. Got a dasher.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a whole. I mean, one thing I've learned from the show, Lou, and that I think probably since nobody else here, everybody comes on and they're terrific, and they're part of it. They're co-hosts. I mean, I don't think people are guests; they're co-hosts. Is they don't have an appreciation for what it's not what you say; it's what people hear. And if I can, I mean, some people think I have the obligation to. Listen to somebody on Joe Rogan or some crap, and have them say what they really say. And you know what, Lou? I don't need to do that because I know what people are hearing. And I know if I went out tomorrow and I said, IBM's got a new chairman, and stock's been pretty good this year. I don't follow it that much. I do know that the guy who's the new chairman. Is a friend of my buddy Lou's, and Lou says the guy's terrific. And by the way, he's done well with every business since he had a 5-cent lemonade stand. But you know that's my view of what's going on there. I didn't give a recommendation there at all. I guarantee you, everybody listening to the show would say Chief loves IBM. I should buy it. Guarantee you. And that's what I'm concerned about. I'm not concerned about somebody going back and parsing my every word because I know I didn't say that. But the fact is, people heard that. And this administration is very good, if you actually get them on some show where they talk straight, at telling you what they quote really mean, but that's not what people are hearing.
Well, I can't. So I'm as inarticulate as the president is. I'm not going to look necessarily at his words. I don't think I've ever heard him say what you just said. But what I tend to look at is actions. What is this? How does this translate into what we're actually doing? And what you're seeing play out is something that a lot of us who have been following this issue for decades have said, which is if we decide to solve this problem, the dramatic influx of people into this country has been designed to make it impossible to do so without the kind of anecdotal injustice issues that you're addressing.
But that's not what we do here, Lou.
Okay.
That's not
I understand.
What we do here.
That's the argument. That's the argument that gets mustered in an attempt to try to fix the problem.
All right. Anyway, we got stuff to talk about next week. Do you think, final question, do you think those bombs actually did all the way down in there? Your stuff got moved? Or how far? I know
they
put them back huge. I mean, is it 6 months? Is it 10 years? I don't know.
Here's what I'll tell you. Two of my classmates from the Air Force Academy were team leads on designing that weapon and how it was going to be employed. And when I say team leads, these guys ran the programs for like 10, 12 years. That bomb's been around for a while. What they saw in the photographs, the high-resolution photographs, is consistent with the bomb penetrating into an open area, a void, and detonating. It's not consistent with the bomb detonating on the surface or detonating in just solid rock. It detonated, so their take is that the bomb got into an open space somewhere below the surface and explode it.
I would sort of agree with that. Well, I don't know anything about it. I just looked at them, but I think you're probably right.
But that's what they say. They said what we projected, what was going to happen with this thing, and based on studies from World War II and the use of other bunker busters in Gulf War I, what we see from those pictures on the surface is what we would expect to see if those bombs got into a space and detonated.
What makes them bunker busters? Is it the weight of the bomb or the hardness of the capsule?
The hardness of the capsule, the fusing design, the weight, the delivery speed, all of that. They're designed to go through, literally punch into solid rock and go a certain...
Well, I think it hurt these guys real bad. I don't know if it's been obliterated. I don't know if I go with that exaggeration.
Let me put it this way. Those warheads are 5,000 pounds of explosive. So 5,000 pounds of explosive detonating in a confined space repeatedly.
Oh, I don't think you want to be in there.
probably did a lot of damage. But that's all I can tell you. I mean,
we're going to end this with some agreement. I agree with you.
Okay.
All right, take care of yourself, bud. Stay away from the rain. By the way, you better wear a hat if it's going to be a rain, hailing
like that. I run for cover when I see that stuff.
Those big old Stetson cowboy hat, that should protect you.
My head's too fat.
Oh God.
See you next week.
All right. SP futures up 22, NASDAQ futures up 117. Do we have Andrew?
We do.
Andrew,
good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Geez. I don't know. I sometimes I can't understand sometimes where the other side goes on this, but I guess I'm just I was actually accused last weekend, Andrew, because I actually do my own research on the numbers. I was accused of being a stupid Democrat. That's where we are in this world, I guess, huh?
Well, you've got an inquiring mind, and being in Washington, I could argue both sides of your very interesting discussion with Lou just now. But instead of arguing, I'll just go back into the memory bank when I was a newspaper reporter and I was covering an immigration hearing something like 40 years ago, and it was a madhouse, and it was all these immigrants for a hearing. And I overheard the judge say to, I think, a government prosecutor on these immigration cases, "This is chaos. Why are you bringing all these people in from all over the place, as far as New Jersey to here in Connecticut, when we can't possibly hear their cases? And it's just a total mess." And the prosecutor agreed it's a total mess. This is 40 years ago. And then they looked at me and said, "Are you a lawyer?" I said, "I'm a reporter." And they said, "You can't report what we just said." And I said, "Why not?" And they said, "Well, we forbid it." And I said, "Well, too bad. I'm here and I heard it, and there's going to be a story tomorrow." So, at any rate, here's to connect the dots on that down memory lane. One, it's been a mess for a very long time, and people know that, and for various reasons, they don't want to fix it, they can't fix it. The other thing is, back in the day, there were news organizations that had time and money to... I don't think that was an assignment, but it was kind of my beat, covering the federal government. And so I just thought it'd be interesting. And it was so unusual that they didn't expect it. But these days, it would be unusual because the news organizations can't afford it. And if the reporter did try to report things, they might have to worry about problems back at the office, well, they told you not to report it. So that's the end of my story. What do you think, Tom?
Some of the stuff you see, I really question that this is really our place. I mean, the idea, I would say that some of the people who've got here illegally, some of the drug trade, some of those things. Drug trade was here before those people were here. People in this country are making a lot of money from the drug trade. I abhor the drug trade. I drive through these neighborhoods and I see people that are, I think, are probably 35 years old. They look like they're 70. I mean, the health issues, the fact that it doesn't look like anybody's even employable. I mean, I still get out and around as much as I can, Andrew. I see these problems and I see somewhere along the line somebody's making a lot of money on this. Now we're gonna blame all of it on the people who, I'm going to say there were a period of a couple of years during the Biden administration where more people were let in. People were let in during the Trump administration the first time, too. People forget that, right? And there's probably a solid group of, you know, maybe as much as a million or a million and a half that we probably would be better off if they weren't here, right? There's probably a million and a half people have been here their whole lives that were better off they're not here, too, right? But, no, I understand that. But the idea that the whole, if you look at the entire amount of people that are here that are not, I'm going to say, I'm looking right at the numbers right now, that it looks like 87% of the population is either native-born citizens or naturalized citizens. Okay, so that leaves you 13%, which is roughly 40 million people. Now, how many people are in colleges here? How many people are on work visas? How many people have been here for 40 years and just never went through the process? I mean, how many people have Social Security cards that are illegal and are still paying in? How many people are paying into Medicare that, guess what, aren't going to be covered? This is a massive cesspool of crap, in my mind, that could be straightened out. The people we don't want here, I suppose we should get rid of. I get that part. But to group this all together and say we have, like, you know, 30 million criminals here, I just can't do that. And the guys that are far on the right, they lobbed this part in about, by the way, they're all voting Democratic, which I don't buy for a second because I know about 10 of them and they all voted for Trump. So, I mean, do I think there's a problem here? Yeah, I just don't like the generalization where this number keeps getting bigger and bigger and all of a sudden the Polish cleaning lady who's been here for 20 years, all of a sudden she's my enemy. No, she's not. I mean, I don't like the way it's heading, Andrew, and people seem to be forgetting the numbers along the way, and I don't like that ever because I'm a numbers guy. So that's kind of my position on the whole mess.
Well, I'm in violent agreement. It's a mess. It has been a mess, but part of the reason it's not solvable in the current environment is various people on multiple sides don't want a solution. So, for example, Lou made a lot of great points, but one is that I would disagree with. He says, well, you don't see Trump saying things that are outright wrong on this. And I'm thinking, what about the whole campaign issue? They're eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. This is a huge big thing that was. Now it disappeared right after the election. What about the people who's eating the dogs? Who's eating the cats? And you need a professional, both government investigators, but private sector people, to solve the problems, root out the problems in an equitable way. And one of the solutions, and this I agree with Luan, he said, well, you could stop it by sanctioning the employers. Well, exactly. Or making it difficult for them to hire the people. But here's why not. Because the employers are contributors. The employers have lobbies. And so when the agriculture interests and the hospitality interests and the construction interests went to the administration a couple of weeks ago and said, you're killing our, who's going to pick the crops? Who's going to, you know, work in the meat processing plants? Who's going to work in the hotels? The administration listened. So that's why they're not going to force the employers to take action.
Well, I don't know how much you know about the stuff they put in on our industry, but if I'm going to assume you're not a felon, and I think you're a citizen. Now, if you sign up an account at PTI, my brother and the people who work here have to go through a whole process of checking you out on Interpol and all kinds of other crap to find out if you're a bad person. And by the way, if you want to send up a partnership, we have to investigate every one of the partners. Now, why the bleep is that our job when you're sending money in from a Citigroup bank account and you have an address, you live someplace? Why is all of a sudden that our issue? And what Lou says, I guess, makes some sort of sense, except if you have a restaurant, a construction firm, or if we hire a guy, okay? Why, I mean, or a lady. Suppose we want to hire somebody, and maybe we want them to work back office or compliance or broker, whatever the hell it is. Somebody comes in, they fill out an application, they give us a social security number, they give us an address. I guess we could look at a driver's license, but I don't know why you would. And we hire them. Why is it our obligation? And oh, by the way, the first paycheck, we send a chunk of their money and a chunk of our money to government and to the social security number. And what if I found out that the young lady who's 35 was here on a student visa when she was 25 and just never went home and has a social security card and had a work visa for a while and now she skipped? Why is that my job to investigate that? I mean, what am I supposed to do? Pull her pants down and check whatever? I mean, I don't get it. I have no idea. I don't like the fact that I got to check you out at Interpol because, by the way, Citigroup should have done that, or somebody should have done that. It's not like you're walking in and handing me a tub of cash, because we don't do that. I mean, I'm totally mystified as who makes up these rules and is there any sort of intelligence behind any of them?
Well, there's supposed to be. Here's the process that we kind of grew up with that created irritations and anomalies. But the official process, and you know it, and so do your listeners, so I'm just briefly reminding everyone, is these regulations go out for public comment, and people comment, mostly groups, and the administration in whatever area we're talking about takes the public comments and synthesizes them and say, okay, here's our regulation. And presumably it's created according to logic, public opinion, and so forth. And maybe not. So maybe it can be changed. But in this case, the rules you're talking about were created long ago and supposedly are rational. But to change them, you need a process of people who are motivated to try to do the right thing. Now, here's where we get into investigators and critics and watchdogs, which if they echo what we want, we like them. But if they're saying things we don't want, they're irritants that need to be crushed and prosecuted. So Wayne couldn't join us today, but let me mention one of his relevant stories, which actually amplified reporting originally from Rupert Murdoch's New York Post. And it's that the head of White House personnel, someone named Sergey Gor, G-O-R, is actually born in Russia when he claimed that he was born in Malta. And he's been lying about his past. He's a former campaign worker. And he's in charge of hiring people for the Trump administration. He's head of the Office of Personnel Management. And he's got a phony resume that hides the fact that he was born in Russia and a bunch of other stuff. So if you're irritated about these regulations that you're talking about, what about this guy?
Well, you know, when... It's, by the way, Lou is never cavalier. He always thinks what he says. But when I said people are paying into something that they're never going to get from, and he said, I don't care about that. Well, if you look at the payroll tax revenue in this country, which is what everybody pays on your Medicare and your Social Security and unemployment too, and then it has to be also part of the stuff that the company pays. Their part of Social Security is $1.7 trillion. So if we're saying 13% of the people, which is probably high, are paying in, let's say 10%, that are never going to get any money back, some might, it's $170 billion. We're not talking about chump change. I mean, well, you look at these numbers, they're huge.
Yeah, well, the reason that continues, it's kind of like an extra tax on whether you call them undocumented or illegals. And you say, people say, well, they're here illegally, let's make them pay more, pay and not get benefits. And so, you know, educated insiders know that and know that that's, in effect, the trade-off. Whereas, you know, that they don't have a pressure group, you know, in a way. Well, they kind of do. I mean, the activist groups. But they have kind of other issues. And it's in effect, a tax that benefits some sectors of society, even though it's fundamentally not rational or fair, except if you say, make them pay.
So I guess we think in our mind they're getting such a great deal here that we get to take money from. You know that's you know what, that's sort of similar. When I was whole different world when both of us were young, whole different world when they actually did. I mean, now we have all these repair projects going on, you know, bridges and you know, and there's nobody working there. It's one shift. There's not enough people. And I'm not saying drag people across the border, but they did this on the, must have been before freshman year of college, so a long time ago. They were having one of the first redos of the Dan Ryan, okay? It ended up, when it was built, you know, they estimated a certain amount of traffic, so they put this much thickness of concrete, and it turns out, guess what, the traffic was like double. So they were going to redo it and put a thicker stuff, you know, whatever, the whole routine. And they were going to hire people, but it was going to be, I don't know, it was going to be 8 hours. It was going to be 24/7, essentially, to get it done. So none of this crap where you go by at 4 in the afternoon and there's nobody working and then the cars are all snared, you know, type of thing. So we went, Buddy and I went like 3-4 days in a row to where they supposedly were hiring, you know, helpers. Plus, you know, when you're young, you want to work construction because you get stronger, you hit the ball further in softball. You know, it's a male thing to do. So we're waiting and we're waiting. And finally, I start to become friendly with this one black dude. And, you know, and the guy had a family. And I'm sitting there going, this guy deserves a job more than I do, you know, type of thing. I got to go do something else. Well, of course, there's another guy. It tells me, well, you guys aren't going to get hired. We're with the coalition. And I go, all right, what exactly, I was an inquiring mind even at that age. What exactly is the coalition? Well, we've got this community guy that's getting us in. And I said, well, what's the cost of that? And I think they were going to pay at the time big, you know, big dough. It was like $8.59 an hour. This is 1970. And he goes, yeah, we got to give him $1 an hour. Now, I guess, and I'm not going to put, Lou would never say this, but I guess you could say, well, that's fair, because look how much he's making. I should get some. In somebody's mind, it's justified, right? I mean, and sure enough, they never hired. And on a Sunday night, they called up all the right people and did all the hiring on a Sunday night, and none of the people that were told to come back Monday morning, you know, just regular people that weren't part of the coalition, got hired. So somebody's getting $1 an hour from the 300 people they hired. So I guess if you're have some mental, you know, mentality, it's okay to steal from those guys because they got a job they wouldn't have got otherwise, and maybe I would have gotten it instead of them. Well, that, in somebody's morality, that's okay. It's okay to steal Social Security from people because they shouldn't be earning anyway, and they're doing better than they would be in Mexico. I guess that's somebody's morality. It's just not mine.
Well, you're in Chicago where I was born, so let's think about a little history there. They had the big city machine back in the day, and you know, a lot, let's go back 60 years into the history books. you know, if you're part of the governing coalition, that helps you get a job, doesn't it?
But the jobs were, you know, I'm not going to, I'm with you on that, you know, but there's almost like a, George Stigler, Nobel Prize winner, and I had for class twice at the University of Chicago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
He was spectacular.
Legend.
And if I took one class, and I go, I got to take another class, no matter what he's teaching. But he actually thought that the patronage system was at least as efficient as the civil service system. And I got one job due to the patronage system. I became a janitor at Chicago Public Schools. But it was kind of a different time, Andrew. I mean, if you got the nudge for that, and they never, I was probably too young to be a precinct captain. I had to tell them I was 21, but if you got the nudge for something like that, it's my aunt or my uncle who did it for me, was the head of the engineers union. And my aunt said, they love these college kids. They show up, they work hard. In those days, if your uncle got you a job, the thought of you ever not showing up or being an ass, that never crossed your mind. And somebody who you know gets a job as a bridge tender or something, these aren't good jobs. And you have to, okay, I got to go stand out in front of the voting booth once every 4 years. I guess that's not too much to ask. I mean, if Eddie Burke, who's I guess now in jail or was going, if somebody runs to him and says, hey, Eddie, Andrew, it looks like it's a 3-month wait, which it probably shouldn't be, for all these permits, how about putting me to the top of the list or the top 10? Well, how is that? How is it? And he says to you, well, the precinct captain in your area just died. How about helping me out? And you say, screw you. What kind of world is that? Why should the guy do it for you for nothing?
Well, there's a...
I'm not talking about cash in his pocket. I'm saying, hey, how about, you know, we're doing something...
No, exactly. And the reason I'm hemming and hawing it, so I'm trying to think whether to do a supposedly interesting anecdote or keep it to the news, but I'll just say George Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winner with a sense of street smarts and practical wisdom on that. I agree. And to tie it into the news, you know, if people are upset at primary results, let's say New York, where the state assemblyman just won, in effect, the inside track to be mayor, we've got a primary system, but the primary system is heavily reliant on social media as opposed to what we're talking about, the old Daley, Richard Daley senior system of where the party is strong. Now the parties are weak, both Democrat and Republican parties. They're very weak. And so you have, without that system you were talking about, you have who looks good for 30 seconds on social media and wins the primaries. And that's not necessarily better governance. And so it goes back to what your professor, George Stiglitz, was saying.
Well, you know, it's I tried to put it in my best educational language, which I can do once in a while. And I think the term I used was the skill set needed now to be elected is not necessarily the skill set you want from the guy in office or lady.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, that what this assemblyman gets elected on a platform that the cost of rents and food is too high, and he's going to tax the billionaires and make things better. And the young people and others are saying, hey, we're for that. Let's elect the guy and wait till he tries to implement it.
Well, how do you zero out the fact that you've got, I mean, in this country, I mean, unless you're, you know, some sort of a you know, the brain of a gnat, if that. You have to have some kind of an idea that an amazing amount of the wealth is going to a smaller and smaller percentage of the people. I mean, that's there for everybody to see. And you look around, and a lot of the people that you know, even though they seem to be working hard, and they're not keeping up. They're absolutely not keeping up, and I could go through, you know, any number on earth, because this is what I do, telling you you're not keeping up. And some people seem to be able to, you know, pay $10 billion for the Lakers. And everybody else sitting there going, well, that's interesting. What does $10 billion even look like to the rest of the world? And you see this happening. And somebody, the person on the bottom seems to understand that it's not quite even. He doesn't quite know how it is. And you end up having to say, well, we have to tax somebody. Well, how much more can you get out of the person that makes 40 grand a year? So that it only leaves the people that have a real lot of dough, that don't seem to be paying much of it. I mean, you've got some people that have had, now I have my issues with the capital gains tax, and I would switch it, I'd index it, I'd do all that stuff. But the idea that if you own, you know, if you bought $1 million worth of IBM and it's now worth, you know, $50 million, and you croak that your kid gets it at the now basis price of $50 million, and nobody ever pays taxes on the 49, most people would say, well, that's interesting, but that doesn't help the guy who just has cash, right? I mean, it just makes it. It used to be that when you generated wealth in this country, you made $100 a week, you spent 80, and you saved 20, and that's how you generated wealth. Now, that's not it. You have to have some sort of assets. You have to have something to where the your wealth is not getting from what you earned in 99% of the cases. It comes from, oh man, I bought Apple when it was here. I bought Nvidia when it was here. I bought three houses when everybody else had one. That's in general is sort of unhealthy, Andrew. And I think, you know, but it's been going on for a long time, and I think people don't even really recognize that that's really it's. And people look around and say, well, gee, how is it that these guys bought this team 20 years ago for $20 million, and now they just sold it for $8 billion or some incredible number? It doesn't seem right. I mean, how is it that went up that fast, yet my paycheck's only doubled, you know, type of thing?
It's the people who have clout shape the rules. And the people both who vote for Trump and for the New York primary winner, they're upset, and they want extreme solutions, and they don't have the knowledge or patience to think through what would the solutions be.
Andrew, we're gonna have to go to break here, bud. So hold that thought, will you? SP Futures up 16, NASDAQ Futures up 80. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Andrew on the board. We have Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures up 16. NASDAQ Futures up 81. Yeah, we robbed Jimmy of his sports report a little while ago, and I know he's been working on it. Dow Futures up 95. We were up a little more. But still, we're positive, and, you know, we've been positive for a while. And this thing in the Middle East really has helped the markets out worldwide. I mean, they've got the Nikkei up 642. It's 1.6%. Hang Seng over is down 149.6%. It's kind of interesting. They're different directions. Shanghai down 7, so call that one flat. So not much going on in mainland China. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 92.4% up, but not as much it has been. FTSE up 25.3%, CAC around up 8, it's almost flat. Bonds, and these are going to be interesting going forward. We've got the 30-year, or 10-year, down 1/100 at 4.27. We've got the Bund down 1 to 2.54. We've got oil up 42 cents, 65.34. Remember, a week and a half ago, it traded 77. And now with the tensions pretty much off in the Middle East, I actually think that this is going to end up being a one and done, and I think there is going to be some peace over there for a while. I hope I'm not just drinking the Kool-Aid, but I hope I'm right. Brent up 31 cents, 67.99. Natural gas down 4 cents, 3.36. Gold, which has been taken on the chin lately because the fleet of value doesn't look as, doesn't look like the whole world's going to be in war. I hope I'm right on that. Gold up 10.80. 33.53, silver up 41 cents, 36.53. It's a big move in silver. It's over 1%. We've got crypto down 452, but still pretty much at a high, 107.328. Foreign exchange, the euro is at 116.97, so the dollar is down. We have Fed autonomy concerns now with Trump taking shots at the Federal Reserve guy. Don't know why he's doing it. The guy's doing exactly what he wants him to do. British pound, 137. So the dollar's getting pretty much piled on here. Jimmy, what do you got real quick? Traffic, weather, sports. Cubs finally win.
Yes, we did. Cubs did win 8-0 over the Cardinals, and they have the rubber game today. Today in Chicago.
You got up your volume, bud.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Again, the Cubs did beat the Cardinals 8-0, rubber match today. Today in Chicago, we are at 78 degrees, a high of 91. It'll be partly sunny and humid with heavy thunderstorms this afternoon. Tonight, we will drop down to 75. In Phoenix, it's 79 degrees with a high of 107. And tonight will be down to 81. Again, on the traffic, inbound Kennedy to Montrose, 35. Inbound Edens to Lake Cook is now 52. Inbound Eisenhower from Grove, 39. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is 43. And the inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 34. Again, in sports, real quick, the Sox did beat the Diamondbacks, and they are both off tonight. Real quick, as most people know, the NBA had their draft, and Cooper Flagg did go number one, as predicted. And the two Rutgers guards went also in the top five. Back to you, Chief.
All right, Andrew, you got to explain to me, you or Jimmy, explain to me, Lucy's, how Rutgers could have two guys that went in the top five and they weren't even 500.
Well, I used to cover the NBA for a year. I think it was 81, 82. And I've kept up with it since then. A lot of times they're drafting people on the basis of talent or innate abilities that don't necessarily translate into team success. So let me give two examples, one from the last night's draft. The Celtics drafted at 28 a player who was a bench player for a team in Spain, Real Madrid.
Really?
And so you say, well, wait a second. The guy couldn't crack the starting lineup of a European team, and he's averaging, I think, something like 4 points a game, and the Celtics draft him with their only first-round pick. But here's why. The guy's 6'6", 223 pounds, great jumping ability, and that fits their pattern. And one more example, when the Celtics drafted Jaylen Brown 7 or 8 years ago out of the University of California at Berkeley, people said, well, his statistics aren't great. University of California at Berkeley, that's not a Final Four team. But as anyone watching the NBA in recent years can see, the man has great physicality. He also had a personality to which they also study. I got to know Red Auerbach a little bit, and he was a great focus on character and willingness to be coached and learn, and which he wrote about in a great book, MBA Management by Auerbach. And so Jaylen Brown, even though he didn't have the great statistics, 2 years ago, he got the highest contract in NBA history. And so I hope that long-winded answer might approach responding to your question. They're drafting not on team success, but on physical ability that translates into the pro game, and in capability, coachability, and character to withstand the, let's say, dangers or temptations of being a 20-year-old multimillionaire.
Dangerous temptation and some fun, probably.
Oh, well, fun, but
yeah.
The death of Len Bias.
Yeah.
On cocaine right after he was drafted out of, you know, he was generally a good kid from all understanding, but it's exciting and kids are kids.
Hey, Andrew, there's two people now have talked about this New York election. Is New York the same, for those that don't know, when I was younger, Chicago had the traditional Democrat-Republican thing, where a lot of the suburbs didn't. Matter of fact, Evergreen Park, you couldn't even use the same party name two elections in a row. So it would be the Good Government Party, and the next time would be the Better Government Party, whatever stupid name somebody came up with. But Chicago stopped doing that, and now we have this anybody can run for mayor. There's this primary, and sometimes we have 10 people. Hardly anybody shows up to vote, when I say that, considering the size of the population. And the two people that end up in the runoff for mayor, one time they didn't have more, even 100,000 votes apiece. And then those are the two people you have to choose your mayor. So it's a totally different sort of an election with all different nuances. Now, is New York now have that same model as Chicago?
Yeah, plus ranked choice, which seemed like it would determine things, but it didn't. And let me be specific. I was just...
Well, how many people were on the ballot?
There was about 8 or 9.
Really? Okay, so like here, all right.
And here's the winner. I didn't mention his name before, but his name is Zohran Mamdani, and he's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and he's a proponent of government-run grocery stores and et cetera, et cetera. And he ended up with 43% plus of the vote in a, let's say, 8-person or so primary. And the former 3-time governor of New York, scandal-plagued, as we say, Andrew Cuomo, got only about 36%, even though Cuomo had been leading in the polls.
So but who got... All right, so how...
Cuomo,
that's up to
New York State. And the 36% or so that Cuomo got is so far below the 50% threshold that he basically conceded the race, even though they haven't applied the ranked choice.
Well, there's no runoff?
Pardon me?
Now, in Chicago, there would be a runoff, the top two people. In New York, there isn't. This guy just wins?
Well, he didn't just win because the official results will be sometime after July 1st when they count the...
No, what I'm saying is...
ballots. But considering that the third-place person, the controller of New York, who got about 11%, told his supporters to rank Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist, first, ahead of Cuomo, it's almost impossible that Cuomo could go from 36% to 50%, where it's a lot easier for Mamdani to go from 43%.
But there's not going to be another election.
No, there'd be one. The runoff will be authenticated. It's not a runoff, but the ranked choice process has to count the absentee ballots and everything.
Okay, so they, right now it's different from here. Now here, he would run in a second election against Cuomo.
Yeah. So just the quick thing on the New York case, Mamdani will be the Democratic nominee. However, oddly enough, New York has a long history of electing Republicans as mayor, going back to John Lindsay.
Okay, so this is back to the old Chicago style. There's still going to be a Democrat-Republican election somewhere.
Yeah, but in November, with the incumbent mayor, who's Eric Adams, is running as an independent, it's possible that Cuomo might run. So you might have four legitimate people along with a kind of a Republican candidate who's a former guardian angel, perennial candidate. So there'll be a November election, but Mamdani will probably win that. But it underscores the weakness of the party apparatus, the centrist coalition, that they're not able to compete in a primary and actually have a solid candidate, because Cuomo was a flawed candidate. He had to resign because of sex scandals and other problems. So why can't they come up with a candidate who could win, who has governance experience, and not just be a New York assemblyman?
The issue is now people identify, and I don't want to be one of those guys to say, you know, if anybody's only had, you know, lunches when they were 5 years older, if the school system was just better. We're at the point where, you know, and Trump is very good at this, by the way. He has an amazing skill set in this. He identifies a problem that people have. He has, in a lot of cases, it's a real complicated solution, one that he probably didn't even get, or maybe he does, but the idea that rents are too high in New York is absolutely true. I mean, it's absolutely true.
And a lot of other places, too.
Yeah, but I'm saying, and I could probably make, if you gave me, God, if I was smart as when I was younger, if you gave me a week and some people to work with me, I could trace Federal Reserve stuff over a certain number of years where people who have owned stuff have done better than people that have rented. And there's no economic, I go back to my days in school, there's no economic theory at all if you start out with a competitive society. There's no economic theory at all that says a renter over a long period of time should do worse than the owner. There's none whatsoever, because the return should be the same.
Well, it's a political theory, which is that homeowners vote and contribute and are better organized than people who have to worry about moving and paying rent all the time.
Well, you do have the issue of either if you own a building, your interest is deductible, or whether you're just a regular mortgage person, that's the only kind of interest deduction left that regular people have. Used to be you could deduct all interest, either as an individual or as a company. Well, now the companies still get to deduct it, people don't. And how people don't recognize that that's a serious flaw in the system. I don't, out of all the problems we have, Andrew, some are so blatant out there. And I'm just a poor kid economist that used to go to school. How you have PTI can deduct people's health insurance, yet I can't deduct it. I mean, what is the purpose of that? Who dreamed that up? We have these inequities in the tax law that nobody seems to even give a crap about. I mean, it's
well, and the people who do are being hollowed out of positions to do something about it. So, for example, you know, we have the Doge people, the young politically loyal people who come in and overturn the civil service. And if people really cared about waste, fraud, and abuse, the Inspector General system was created under Jimmy Carter. And as a newspaper reporter, I'd get the reports on abuses and write stories about it. Well, President Trump got rid of all the inspector generals. So, and they replaced them with political loyalists. Now, one of them, a young man who goes by the name of Big Balls, he just resigned. There's no continuity here. A guy just comes in, he's firing people, he's getting everybody's data. And now he quit. And I told you before, the audience, I shared is a better way to put it. We've got a Russian native lying about his resume who's in charge of all federal personnel appointments at the Office of Personnel Management.
An ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of talent with some people. It's the exact same for him as is the mayor of Chicago. Same mentality.
And by the way, going back, and it's not specifically a Chicago story, but there is a great movie people remember, On the Waterfront, with Marlon Brando, about 1951.
I could have been a contender.
Pardon me?
I could have been a contender.
But it's not only about, you know, the great acting in the movie, but the fundamental story is if you're in the union, you can get a job as a longshoreman, and you got to go along with the system. So it's kind of what you're talking about politically. Marlon Brando tries to break out of that, and it doesn't really work that well.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a. I'm kind of surprised. You know, maybe not, Andrew. When I grew up in a. My time of growing up was the Vietnam stuff, the big inflation stuff. You had people that tried to find solutions and kind of sort of did after a while. I mean, it wasn't like it was easy. And now we seem like we're going through the same play. I mean, I listened to Trump the other day ranting and raving about the inflation and Jimmy and Biden's inflation. I just for, you know, for bleeps and giggles, I went through the last however many years, and I think you'll kind of understand this. In Trump's first reign or term, whatever you want to call it, the money supply, which even though nobody pays attention to it, and Powell, I don't know, he never mentions it, which is kind of strange. Neither does anybody have a question. Well, the money supply is actually the incredible driver of price levels. I think if you ask people, what if everybody who had a dollar bill immediately had a $2 bill, I think people would say, okay, well, if I owed you $20, I now owe you $40, right? Everything would just get adjusted, and you don't get anywhere. All you do is change numbers. Or it's like Italy pulling three zeros off the end of the lira, right? I mean, it gets you to the same place. But people don't necessarily believe that now. So we've had the Federal Reserve doing what they're doing, very similar to the Nixon era, the LBJ era, and the Gerry Ford era. Very similar. It's almost absolutely verbatim. In Trump's first term, the money supply was up from January 2017 to January 2021, 46%. That never happened. That didn't happen in the 4 years of World War II. It didn't happen. Civil War was about 10% a year, and it took 4 years, so maybe it went up like 40% in the Civil War. Now, the Confederacy did, and it's one of the reasons why they lost, by the way. They devalued their currency. In Biden's entire term, the money supply went up 11% total. Now, in Trump's 4 months, it's up 2% in 4 months. So if you multiply that by three, he's going to do 6% in the first year. And yet, every outpeep of his mouth is going to be that it's this guy's inflation. And I have conservative friends that will say, Biden is just like Jimmy Carter. And I go, whoa, 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 whoa. It was Carter's inflation. Okay, now wait a minute. Did you forget Nixon's wage and price controls? What were those? Okay, so you forgot about them or didn't care to look. What became of Gerry Ford's national whip inflation now win buttons. What were those? Okay, well now if you're gonna tell the story and blame somebody, you might want to actually do a little research and find out whose fault it was. I mean, or is that too much to ask, Andrew?
It may be too much to ask of political partisans, but I'm so glad you brought it up because I saw your report on this, written report that you shared with some of the guests or contributors to the show, and it's very powerful information that you researched, and yet the fundamental problem is that while it's highly compelling, persuasive, for most people, you mentioned financial figures, math, and after 20 seconds, the eyes glaze over and they want to think about some more exciting topic, not realizing that this affects their lives in ways that they need to think about, but most people don't want to think about it.
Well, it comes down to, I mean, everybody, you say to yourself, I mean, who does inflation benefit? It benefits people that own assets, but the number one benefiter is the government. If the price of a Ford goes from 20 grand to 30, and the government's charge 8% tax, they're now getting 8% on another 10 grand for the same car, right?
Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of things, and I don't know if there's...
We're out of time, but give me a minute.
There was just a story. There's a blogger, Judd Legum, on Popular Information, and he talks about AI and how it's going to devastate the income of vast numbers of people who are authors and their readers, because it will cut out the incentive to write books. And the legal decision is that the AI companies can take books and feed them into their training apparatus, millions of pages, and basically take the work of authors and put it into AI. And this seems like, oh, gee, everybody can click on that. But what it does is it devastates the livelihoods of people who spend years as researchers and writers putting together reports, kind of like what you just did, but at a book length. So I'll end it on that. I know we're out of time.
Andrew, thank you. Where are you? Are you roasting in New York, or where are you?
I'm roasting in D.C., but it's worse in New York, oddly, and I hear it's pretty bad in Chicago. So.
Well, it's been pretty hot down in St. Louis for the last few nights. Boy, St. Louis has got to be one of the worst places in the summertime. You're low and ugh. It's got to be like Washington, you know, just humid all the time. So you're not up at Saratoga like a man of your means?
The means are... what you make of it each day.
There you go. S&P futures up 15, NASDAQ futures up 75. Still up. We were up more a little bit ago, but still we're up. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.